Off, we had just finished John chapter 5, and if you'll remember, John chapter 5, you can remember by the three fives. It's the three words that describe the chapter. Does anyone remember what those five words are? It's going to have to do with equality, Jesus and the Father. You remember? Jesus is equal with God, all right? So that's how you remember John 5. That's what that whole chapter is about. Then Jesus makes those five claims, but then he supports it with the five witnesses. He testifies concerning himself, John the Baptist, the works that he does, the Father, and then finally Moses and the Scriptures. And so that's where we left off last time. Today we are finally going to get into two more signs, actually, that is of the seven signs that are recorded in the Gospel of John, and then we're going to get to our first I am statement, maybe this week, probably into next week, actually, and that is when Jesus is going to say, I am the bread of life. So to start our class, we're in John chapter 6, beginning in verse 1, and we read beginning in verse 1, after this. Now, that's one of those statements that sometimes the gospel writers like to use that confuse us, because how long after this? And the answer is, we have no idea. It could be as up to a half a year following the preceding events. It could be longer than that. The only clue we get is it's going to say that the Passover feast was at hand. So this is in the springtime, in one of the years of Jesus' ministry, presumably probably in his early first year of ministry, began it in the summertime. We go almost a year later, and we're now at the Passover feast. So it says, Jesus went away to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, which is also known as the Sea of Tiberias. And we'll talk about why it's named that in just a second. A large crowd was following him because they saw the signs that he was doing on the sick. And Jesus went up on the mountain, and there he sat down with his disciples, and it says again that the Passover feast of the Jews was at hand. Now, when you read something that is a sea, we usually think of a very large body of water, okay? The Sea of Galilee is not really the Sea of Galilee. We would call it a lake. It's the Lake of Galilee. It's 13 miles long, and it's 7 miles wide. And here's a picture of it. You can see from one side, this would be the east bank, looking towards the west bank, and Capernaum would be up here. You can see all the way across the water. But because it's 600 feet below sea level, actually, when winds would come through, it would really mesh up this lake pretty badly. And that's why we read about the storm waters that we do so often, actually, in the Scriptures. Just to know geographically where it's at, I'm going to have a blown-up picture in just a second. But Jerusalem's going to be down here. Here's an actual sea, the Mediterranean Sea. Here's the Dead Sea. The Jordan flows up. It actually flows down. It begins up here and flows down through the Sea of Galilee, and then it goes down to the Dead Sea. But here's a blown-up picture. Where we're going to be at the beginning of John chapter 6 is where Luke records is a place called Bethsaida. And Bethsaida is going to be just up here northeast of where the Jordan flows into the Sea of Galilee on the north side. Capernaum is going to be where we're at the end of chapter 6. That's right here. And we're going to talk about that a little bit today. Very fascinating historical city. And there's a lot still there for us to see if you actually go there and visit Capernaum. Now, the Sea of Galilee was also called the Sea of Tiberias. Now, the city of Tiberias was actually built by Herod Antipas, and it was done to commemorate the emperor Tiberius, who reigned from AD 14 to AD 37. And what's interesting is it remained a royal city in Galilee, even under Agrippa. And here's the funny thing. It was built on top of a cemetery. So how would the Jews view a city that was built on top of a cemetery where dead bones lived and where dead people were? It's an unclean city. That's what they thought of it until it actually became, later on, the center of Palestine's rabbi center in Jerusalem. So most of the rabbis officially moved their dwelling place and their study location to the city of Tiberias. So convenient, when they can use it for themselves, they just happen to change their mind on whether or not it was unclean or not. Isn't that interesting how a lot of times people will do that? Their position on something is this and they're dogmatic about it, but then something happens with their family or something happens with them and all of a sudden they're a little bit more lenient regarding that kind of a situation. That's what the Jews did. But that's just geographically, we need to be familiar with this because all of chapter 6 is going to be dealing with this area at the Sea of Galilee. And where we're going to begin is right up here to the north in this place called Bethsaida. So this large crowd is following Jesus. They've seen his signs. He's doing all these different miracles and is healing people from the sick, or that are healing people that are sick. And so we read in verse 5, "Lifting up his eyes then and seeing that a large crowd was coming toward him, Jesus said to Philip, 'Where are we to buy bread so that these people may eat?'" Now let's jump forward just a little bit. The number of just men that are counted here is 5,000 men. But what Luke records for us, or sorry, what Matthew records for us, is that there were 5,000 men besides women and children. So let's just say that half the men had brought their wives. We're now up to 7,500. And even if each woman had only one child, which probably wasn't the case, they had many children in that time period, of course, we're looking at a rough estimate, at least 10,000, probably more like 12 to 15,000 people that are following Jesus at this time period. And Jesus turns to one of his 12 disciples and says, "Hey, where can we go buy bread to feed 15,000 people?" All right, where are you going to go? They don't have bread factories, okay? They don't have Costco's. And so Philip is going to respond to Jesus. And we'll get back to verse 6 in a moment. Philip answers him and he says, 200 denarii worth of bread would not be enough for each of them to just get a little. Now, if you'll remember, a denarii was a day's wage. So here, Philip says, basically, two-thirds of a year's salary would not be enough to feed 15,000 people with what they would need to actually have a meal. So then Andrew, usually Simon's the one with a smart mouth, okay? Here it's going to be Andrew that's going to have the smart mouth. And so he pipes up and he says, "Well, we've got a boy here with 5 loaves and 2 fishes, but what are they for so many?" And I don't think he was being serious. I think he was being sarcastic when he says this, like, "How are we going to feed this many?" And Andrew goes, "Well, we've got 5 loaves and 2 fishes. You think that's going to do it? We've got 15,000 people to feed here." But Jesus had asked this statement towards them for a couple of reasons. The first reason we're told here in verse 6, and he says he did this to test them because Jesus knew what he was going to do. One of his disciples responds and says, "It's impossible. There's nowhere that we can buy this much bread, and we don't have that much money." Another disciple pipes up and says, "Well, we've got 5 loaves and 2 fishes. Maybe that'll take care of it." But what Jesus is going to do is going to be extraordinary. And Jesus is going to command to have the people sit down and recline. And so all the people are going to sit down. And Jesus is about to perform this extraordinary miracle to feed the 5,000. We'll read about in just a moment. But before we do that, I want to ask this question. And that is, why does Jesus feed these people? Why does Jesus feed the 5,000 plus that are following him? He didn't have to feed them. And so I want to look for some answers that we're going to find in the text and that you might have right now. Why does Jesus feed these people? And because they're hungry is not an answer. So if you're going to answer that, put your hand down. So, all right, Clinton, go. Okay, maybe. I don't see any evidence that they were so far away from civilization that they would die if Jesus didn't feed them right away. But Jesus, of course, recognizes, I'll put this, Jesus recognizes their physical needs, okay? Were they probably hungry after following Jesus and listening to him teach. Okay. Okay, Dave?
I think a lot of, most importantly, the reason why Jesus did this miracle at that time was also to show that all blessings flow through God, number one, that you need to be totally dependent upon him. Two, Jesus did it to bring glory to the Father, to show that he was the Son and that he and God are one.
Okay.
So that's the main purpose, to show that God provides for every need when you are with him.
Okay. Lonnie?
Well, Jesus is the Son of God, and he knows the hearts of all men. And I think that he could tell that they loved him, but he loved them because they were his people.
Okay. Okay. What else? In the back.
It's a parallel to feeding them spiritually.
Okay. I want to circle that, because Jesus is going to come back to this for the rest of chapter 6. And he's going to go back to the loaves and say, I am the bread of life. And so they're going to look at this miracle and make a connection with Moses and that he's the prophet. And we're going to talk about that in just a second. But Jesus is going to declare that what he offers is greater than what Moses had to offer. And so we'll get there. So yes, what else? Okay.
There was nothing
really
too hard.
Okay. Jesus, the one who could command a rock for bread to come from it, did Satan know the power Jesus had? Absolutely. Okay.
It's going to say it sets the table for his message that he's going to do.
Right.
He puts the crowd into a positive setup for what I'm saying. Something that you can put your hands on, feed on, know, and...
Yes. Jesus is the expert at setting things up to make his argument. And here it's like a sign act, where he's going to do something that is going to point to a greater spiritual truth later. So good.
Well, it says, to test his apostles.
Okay. Okay.
Once he had died, then they would remember all these things.
I'm so glad you said that. And let me explain why. What's going to be interesting about John chapter 6 is we have the feeding of the 5,000. And then later on, for the rest of the chapter, we have the discussion about Jesus being the bread of life. And then stuck right in the middle, in a very awkward place it seems, is Jesus walking on the water. We go from bread to another miracle, back to bread. Okay? Do you see that in this chapter? And so one might ask, why does John put that there? And we're going to look at the Gospel of Mark when we get there in just a few minutes, because Mark's going to say something interesting. Jesus is going to walk on the water, and Mark is going to record that, and they were astonished because they did not understand the loaves. Okay, what's the connection between the feeding of the 5,000 and walking on the water? And so John's going to put that there for a purpose, and we'll look at that. But these are all good things and all correct things. One, the text very specifically tells us he did this to test them. Every sign is going to point to the sonship of Jesus Christ, that you might believe in him, because life is found in believing the Son. And Jesus is going to talk about that when he gets to Capernaum in the synagogue. So that's one of the reasons. But the other thing here is Jesus knows their hearts, and he is setting this up to teach them a spiritual truth about who he actually is and what you ought to believe that he is. Not just being amazed by his signs, but being amazed by what those signs point to about Jesus when you understand the scriptures. Yeah, Brad. Good.
On that. There's people who are seeking out him and his teachings and his word. And he's going to make sure and have compassion on those kinds of things.
Right, right. Good. So Jesus is going to feed them, and here's how he does it. And I don't necessarily know how this happens, But it says, he then took the loaves, and when he had given thanks, he distributed them to those who were seated. And so also the fish, as much as they wanted. And when they had eaten to their fill, he told his disciples, gather up the leftover fragments that nothing may be lost. See, they kept doggy bags back then too. And in verse 13, so they gathered them up and filled 12 baskets with fragments from the 5 barley loaves left by those who had eaten. And when the people saw this sign that he had done, they said, this is indeed the prophet who has come into the world. Let's talk about the miracle first. I don't know how Jesus would have done this. I don't know if it was, you know, almost looked like a magic trick where he hands the fish out to someone and this fish is still in his hand. The way they portrayed it in the Bible series that they did on TV at one point is Jesus lifts up this basket that has the bread in it, and he comes back down and it's overflowing when he brings it back down. I don't know how he would have done it, but he did it. He fed 15,000 people with 5 loaves and 2 fishes. How many of you mothers would have loved to have been able to do that with your teenage kids in your grocery budget, right? Jesus, what he does here is an absolute miracle. But what we need to understand is this is not the purpose of Jesus' miracle, and he's going to state that very specifically later on. Do not do the work for the food that only lasts now, but to do the work for the food which will give you eternal life. Jesus is trying to point them to something else. But just like anyone who has a large gathering and a large following, if you feed them, are you going to have a good response from people? You know, when we do, you know, things with the youth and whatnot, it's amazing the numbers. And just call it for what it is. If you say that there won't be anything provided, bring something. Just numerically, I've found with our youth and with others in this area, half the numbers show up than when you provide a meal, when you provide food. And it's interesting. And what it demonstrates, though, is a lot of people are focused on the wrong thing. When they should be focused on spiritual food, they're focused on that which is temporal or material. And that's what's going to happen with these folks, is they're going to be fed from Jesus, but they're going to make a connection. They're going to say, this is indeed the prophet who is to come into the world. Now, of course, this is the Messiah, but what statement are they referring to, or what passage are they referring to? How did they make a connection between Jesus giving them bread and this is the prophet? Go ahead, Brad. That's exactly correct. And that's the argument they're going to make later in John chapter 6, is they want Jesus to feed him again. So they're going to say, well, why don't you show us a sign to demonstrate who you are? Oh, we have an idea. Here's what Moses did. He fed us. And so they're basically going to ask Jesus, why don't you just feed us again? We want food, is what they say. And Jesus calls them out on this. But they see Jesus giving them bread, and they recognize Moses gave the people manna, and Moses said, there's a prophet coming after me that is like me. So they said, this must be the prophet. Moses gave them water, Jesus gives them water. Moses gave them manna, Jesus gives them manna. This is what they say later on. So they said to him, then what sign do you do that we may see and believe in you? What work will you perform? Our fathers ate the manna in the wilderness, as it is written. He gave them bread from heaven to eat. And here's going to be the great irony. They are asking for bread from heaven from the bread of heaven. They are missing the entire point of what this miracle was to lead them to. They are only concerned with material things, and they are not concerned with spiritual things. Yeah, Wayne, go ahead.
Identifies an individual that they're looking for.
Correct.
And my notes here say that in John 1:21, they asked,
That would be a statement made to John the Baptist. When in verse 20, it says, this is the testimony of John, verse 19, when the Jews sent to the priests and the Levites in Jerusalem, and they asked, who are you? And he confessed, and he did not deny, but confessed, I'm not the Christ. And when they asked him, what then are you? Are you Elijah? He said, I'm not. Then they asked John, are you the prophet? And he says, no. So that was a question made posed to John the Baptist, and John says, I'm not the prophet. Because the prophet was going to be the one whom he testifies concerning, and that is Jesus. But good question. But yeah, that was given to John, not to Jesus. Because when Jesus is going to be asked questions like that, like go back to John chapter 4, the Samaritan woman, when the Messiah comes, he will tell us all things. And Jesus responds and says, he who has spoken to you today is he. I am the Messiah. I am the prophet. And Jesus is going to make that claim like he did previously later on in this chapter as well. So they are making the connection. This is the prophet that Moses was speaking about. And they are so excited about what Jesus has done for them, which actually is astoundingly not really that much, very, very impressive compared to other things. Okay? Jesus fed people. Jesus has taken a man that was lame and made him be able to walk suddenly. I mean, Jesus has been doing all these miraculous healings and casting out demons, and yet when he feeds them, look what they decide they need to do. In verse 15, perceiving then that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king, Jesus withdrew again to the mountain by himself. Jesus feeds them, and immediately they said, this is our guy. This is the one who we want to lead us. This is the Messiah. We're going to make him king because he fed us. And Jesus is going to point out that it wasn't even the fact that Jesus did a sign. It was that he gave them food. It wouldn't have mattered if Jesus had done a miracle to give them the food. The fact that Jesus gave them food is what made them want to make him king. Do you see how shallow their understanding of the Messiah is? Jesus feeds them, and immediately they want to force him to make him king. I imagine some zealots were behind that. They were the ones who were always trying to force things like this to take place. Brad, you had your hand up. Nope. Dad, did you have your hand up? Mick did. Mick. And then Dave.
I don't know how many of you have been in rough seas before. When I read this, I was in that boat. It would make a believer out of me that they rode for about 3 or 4 miles.
Oh, you're jumping ahead of us.
Walking on the sea and throwing into the boat. And they were frightened, but he said, it is I, do not be afraid.
Right.
They were willing, therefore, to receive him in the boat, and immediately the boat was on the land that they were going to.
Right. We're not there yet. We're going to get there in just a few minutes. Sure is. Sure is. Dave.
Having eyes they did not see, and having ears they did not hear.
Okay.
Jesus, out of his compassion, would use that example of the bread to do a parable, if you will, to lay something in front of them to show them the physical need to make the spiritual end.
Good.
And he did that with all that he did. That's how he taught.
Good.
And he's doing it here so that they can see that he is truly the bread of life.
Okay.
And it's just amazing how he talks.
That's it. That's it. I thought I saw one more hand. No? Okay. So this miracle, this is going to teach us a couple of other things about Jesus. One, every miracle teaches something about the authority of Jesus. What does this demonstrate about the authority that Jesus has over this world when you see a miracle like this? This is the power of creation. Some write it as the power of quantity. That God can take that which is nothing and create something. You cannot, no matter how you do it with the math, you cannot take 2 and make it 15,000. If you have 2, you have 2, unless you cut it up into 15,000 tiny pieces, but that's not what Jesus does here. This is not like the Lamnis bread in Lord of the Rings where you take a tiny crumb and you're full for the rest of the day. That's not what Jesus does here. He fills their bellies. Jesus demonstrates his power over creation. And I believe that's part of why Mark is going to write what he does, that they were astonished at Jesus' power over the waves, but they should not have been astonished, because if they understood this miracle, they would have understood that Jesus has the power over creation. If he can take 2 fish and 5 pieces of bread and feed 15,000 people, then he can tell the waters to hush up and they'll stop what they're doing. Okay? Yeah, Donna.
And also, it's not a coincidence that there was 12 baskets left over.
Okay.
Because of the 12 apostles, or the 12 disciples that, you know, his inner circle.
Yeah, maybe there's a connection there. I'm not sure if it would be a strong theological point there. But they each pick up a basket. You know, they've each got leftovers to take home with them, I guess. So that is interesting, the number 12 there. This is also an interesting statement. I'm just going to make this point very briefly. I don't want to spend a lot of time on it. When you look at postmodernism at its root, one of the primary teachings of postmodernism, which, long story short, teaches that Jesus is going to come again and reign on this earth for 1,000 years, and that there's going to be a physical battle of Armageddon here on this earth, and then after that battle, then Jesus is going to take us all home, and they have multiple resurrections and all sorts of things going on. One of the teachings that is that premillennialism, if this is being recorded, just scratch that whole thing. Premillennialism teaches that. And premillennialism, one of the things it's founded on is this notion and is this idea that Jesus failed. That Jesus came to assert a physical kingdom and a physical throne, but the people rejected him. And so we have this makeshift period for the church until God can come and try it again and reign on this earth for 1,000 years. There's a couple of problems with that theory. One is Jesus later on tells Pilate, "My kingdom is not of this world. If it were, my soldiers would fight for me." Would Jesus have failed if he intended to establish a physical kingdom here on this earth? No. That's right. He'd have 10,000 angels at one beckoning call. We sing the song, don't we? Here's the other problem. What did the people want to do with him early on in his ministry? They wanted to make him king. They wanted to force him to become king. It happens several times. But Jesus escapes from them because that is not why he came, and his time had not yet come. And when they finally understand what Jesus came to do, they are going to kill him because they don't like what he represents. They don't like what he came to bring. So just notice that and keep that in the back of your mind. When you talk to someone who comes from a premillennial background and is trying to persuade you that way, show them this passage and demonstrate that, no, the people did want to make Jesus king before they ever rejected him. All right, now we get to where Mick very well transitioned us into, and that's here in verse 16. And this seems to be this random passage that is put here, but it's not so random. One, just the geography. We're going to go from the north. Here's the Sea of Galilee. I'm the sea. Here's Bethsaida up here. They're going to get in a boat and they're going to travel about 5 miles towards Capernaum, which is on the west side, the northwest side of the Sea of Galilee. The people, it appears, thought that they were going to the city of Tiberias. We'll get there in just a moment. But Jesus is not with his disciples. Jesus withdrew and he goes to the mountain by himself to pray. So his disciples go on without him. And it says, when evening came, his disciples went down to the sea and they got into a boat and started across the sea to Capernaum. And it was now dark and Jesus had not yet come to them. The language there seems to demonstrate that they were waiting for Jesus and then finally just said, if we're going to get there, we've got to go. We can't wait anymore for Jesus. So they just get in the boat and they start to go. Verse 18, the sea became rough because a strong wind was blowing. And when they had rowed about 3 or 4 miles, they're almost to Capernaum. It says they saw Jesus walking on the sea, coming near the boat, and they were frightened. Now, why would they be frightened in seeing Jesus coming near the boat? 2 reasons that come to my mind. One, the other Gospels demonstrate they thought it was a ghost. Because, and that is a pretty logical conclusion if you're them, because who walks on water? Nobody walks on water. But when he gets closer, he's going to call out to them, "It is I, do not be afraid." And then they were glad to take him into the boat. But that might be the other reason that originally they were a little frightened, because who walks on water? This is incredible. Jesus just casually strolls out to them. And keep in mind, this is not like a lot of the pictures of Jesus walking on the water. You notice it's like kind of like a crystal clear lake, and he's just kind of trudging along. If this is a storm going on, what's going on with the waves? Right. The ground, the water, the ground in Jesus' case is doing this, and Jesus is just walking over it, walking towards them. Okay, Brad, you've had your hand up for a while.
First of all, according to Mark, Jesus sent them ahead. They didn't just up and decide to do that because waiting for him, Jesus.
Okay.
He says he commanded them to go.
Okay, I missed that point. Okay.
Okay.
Just a different perspective. The language that Jesus had not yet come to them seems to imply they were waiting for him, I had thought. But the different recordings, maybe misunderstanding between Jesus and the apostles. And that's probably why it's recorded differently. So good. Jesus comes to them. He gets in the boat. And notice the text here. Immediately, the boat was at the land to where they were going. I mean, that's pretty astounding. He gets in the boat. And they're glad to receive him. And then they look around. They're not in the middle of the Sea of Galilee anymore. They're docked. And they're just there. Jesus physically transports all of them to a different location. It's kind of like what we read in the book of Acts with Philip and the eunuch, when it says that the Spirit picked up Philip and took him somewhere else. I don't think that situation there is that it just told him to go somewhere else. The text seems to imply Philip just showed up somewhere else. God apparated him, basically. Jesus here apparates him, the boat, and all the disciples, and they just show up on the land here. Yeah, Lorraine.
This miracle was for the eyes of his disciples only.
Right. That's correct. Jesus is not going to tell them, because when he gets to Capernaum, the people can't figure out how Jesus gets there, because they're looking for him in these boats coming from Tiberias, and he's not there. They never saw him get in a boat, so they all get in a boat and are trying to find him. They go to Capernaum. When they find him, they're like, "Rabbi, how'd you get here?" They don't know how Jesus got there, and Jesus doesn't divulge how he got there. "Well, here, let me tell you, I walked on water. And then I calmed a storm, and then I got in a boat, and I apparated us to Capernaum, and that's how I got here." In the normal day. But here, Jesus, this miracle is only done for them, and it's for a specific purpose. Their hearts are still going to be hardened. They don't understand who Jesus is yet. And that's what Mark records for us. And we'll get there in just a moment. But what they should have recognized is who Jesus was. Jesus has demonstrated over and over again the power that he has that comes from God, and that Jesus truly is the Son of God. But they were still hardened their hearts. They still didn't understand this. And we won't really get a confession of this until from Peter at the end of chapter 6, when he says, "You are the Holy One of God. We've come to know this." But it took them some time to come to know this. But if they knew the scriptures, they would have known the power Jesus possessed, because Jesus gets in the boat, the storm's calm, and he brings them to land. And here, Psalm 89, verse 9, "You rule the raging sea, and when its waves rise, you still them." Psalm 107, "Then they cried to the Lord in their trouble, and he delivered them from their distress. And he made the storm be still, and the waves of the sea were hushed. And they were glad when the waters were quiet, and he brought them to their desired haven." That's a reference to God and what God does for the distressed soul in the storms of life and in the physical storms of this earth, Jesus does exactly what this psalm discusses. He comes to them, he rests their soul, he rests the storm, and he takes them to their desired location, their desired haven. And knowing the scriptures, they would have known who does this but God. And that's what is recorded in Mark. It says that he walked to them by the sea. They were terrified, but immediately he spoke to them and said, "Do not be afraid." And he got into the boat, and the wind ceased, and they were utterly astounded, for they did not understand about the loaves, but their hearts were hardened. They didn't understand who Jesus was. And I believe that's why John puts this miracle here, because Jesus does something for only the disciples, not for anyone else to see. And it's going to teach them about who he is, so that way when we get to the end of Jesus' teaching in the synagogue at Capernaum, they come to the conclusion, "You're the Holy One of God. This is what we've come to know and understand by what you've done for us and shown to us." Mick, your hand was up a little bit ago. Did you still have something?
I want to finish what I was saying.
Okay.
These men were professional
fishermen, right. Well, some of them.
They weren't strangers.
About four of them.
To cross in the Sea of Galilee.
Right.
While they were probably a little amazed at the feeding of the 5,000, it's something that they don't see every day.
Mm-hmm.
But what they're in that boat doing, they see every day.
Right.
And all of a sudden, they arrive at the bank. And if they weren't impressed with that, then they're not really fishing.
That's a really good point. Good job. That's a really good point, Mick. Yeah.
They'd also be impressed to add to Mick the fact that they need a boat in order to fish. They understand gravity. They understand that they cannot do anything without that boat to continue their profession. But at the same time, when Jesus came walking upon that water, he shows how he's above the elements, above all creation, that he can actually walk on this element, which that would be just mind-boggling to them, because this is their profession. They know what this water does, and he's walking on it. Mm-hmm. Wow, that had to hit them.
You know, you bring up a point that's interesting, and then I'll get to your comment, Brad. They were experts at this field, weren't they? This was their job. How many times will you see experts in their field say that something is impossible when they read a biblical account and say, "Oh, that just couldn't have happened"? And yet, how many times does Jesus demonstrate to the experts they don't really know what they're talking about, or they don't really know what they're doing? Remember, later on, when Jesus is going to, you know, rise from the dead, he's going to call out to them, "Throw your nets to the other side." They're professional fishermen. Did they know where to fish and when to fish? Yes. But Jesus tells them, "No, you throw your nets over here," and what happened to the nets? They were so heavy, they couldn't even pull them in. And it was at that moment, Peter had seen this often enough, he knew who it was that had called out to them on the shore. He knew, this is Jesus. Only one person can tell me, an expert in my field, that I don't really know what I'm talking about. And I just think that that's peculiar and interesting. Yeah, Brad.
Mark's account, if you go a few verses before what you have up there, I see Jesus' patience with the disciples and their learning. Because according to Mark, he never meant to meet them on the sea.
Right, he was going to pass them by.
He was just going to walk and pass them by and meet them on the shore. But because they saw them and were terrified, and he saw that, and he wasn't even going to stop then. He first notices they're struggling with the boat, but he was going to keep going.
Mm-hmm.
Then he says, sees that they're terrified, and going, okay, it's like he changed direction, went over to meet them, calmed them down, and got them across.
Right.
I see a patience with this inner circle that's like, okay, guys, I got to teach you one more lesson.
Mm-hmm.
And but the intent of Mark indicates is he was just going
to... Not a planned miracle.
Shore at the other side.
Right.
And he took that opportunity to
do something.
He saw their need to be taught a lesson.
And he fulfilled it. Good. Very good. This is Capernaum today. This structure, this is the building more modern that is built over what is commonly known as the House of Peter, Peter's house in Capernaum. There's actually quite a bit of evidence that points us to believe that it might very well actually be the House of Peter. There's a lot of different things there. There's this peacock mural that's in the house. And not only was the fish an early sign of Christianity, but actually the peacock was a sign of Christianity because their feathers won't ever change color. It was a sign of eternity. And so you see that in the house. There's some other evidence, early writings that date back to like the 4th century and the 5th century that show historically that this is what they understood for a long time. So it's possible that this might be Peter's house under here. What's really fascinating is this synagogue right here. Now, this is not the synagogue Jesus taught in and performed miracles in. This synagogue was made of limestone. It was built in the 4th or 5th century. But below it is basalt. It is built on top of the synagogue that the centurion had built. And they said, he built our synagogue. He's worthy for you to listen to him. That was the synagogue that was constructed there. And basalt was a common thing they used to build synagogues and buildings and their structures. And this is the very synagogue that this one is built on top of, the basalt at the bottom. And I don't have a good picture because our internet went kaboots before class and I couldn't pull it up for you. But this is where Jesus would have stood and said, I am the bread of life. This is where Jesus would have performed many of the miracles that he did, is inside this very place right here by the Sea of Galilee. This is it, right here. And it's just amazing, you know, you look at other writings and other books of other people that people follow, you know, there's no archaeological evidence, not even one thing, for anything written in the Book of Mormon or the Doctrines of Covenants, the Pearl of Great Price, or any of those things. And yet all we have to do is walk over to, you know, Israel, and we see thousands and thousands of things that are just as they were written, were in the biblical text. And so that synagogue is still here, and that's where Jesus is going to begin teaching them. We're out of time, but this is a good stopping place. Bottom line, we'll stop here. They're all looking for Jesus because they want another handout. And so Jesus is going to respond to them. This is where we'll end today. He says, truly, truly, I say to you, if you were seeking me, you were seeking me, not because you saw signs, but because you ate your fill of loaves, because I gave you a handout. Do not work for the food that perishes, but for the food that endures to eternal life, which the Son of Man will give to you, for on him God the Father has set his seal. Reminds us of Jesus' words to the Samaritan woman in John 4, not about bread, but about water. If you knew who was saying to you, get me a drink, you would ask him and he would give you living water. Very similar statements Jesus makes here and that Jesus made to the Samaritan woman. And this is where we're going to pick up next time. We'll talk about the bread of life. Thank you so much.